Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hello and welcome to Bookworm. This is Michael Silverblatt, and today I'm very happy to have with me in the studio again Jamaica Kincaid. Her most recent book is My Garden Book. It's published by Farrar, Straus and Giroux, and she is the author from the beginning of At the Bottom of the River, Annie John, A Small Place, Lucy, The Autobiography of My Mother, My Brother, and now My Garden Book. This show is part of Bookworm's ongoing series, Women Writing in the Imagination, conversations with nine prominent women in the arts at the beginning of the 21st century. But by talking about this, it's more interesting to talk about that part of the self that is, yes, defined as a woman, defined as a black woman, defined as a black woman writer, but to speak about the things that are not covered by any of those definitions. I think particularly about Coretta King, who spoke about being black and a woman all her life, and she felt it was more difficult to be a woman. And I wondered, well, how do you tell? And how do you know that the greatest difficulties of all are not being human?
Ha ha. I love that. The thing about being a woman, the real universal thing about being a woman that nobody really ever talks about is that people can tell you you're black and people can tell you you are all sorts of things, but every 28 days you're reminded that you're a woman, and nobody has to tell you that. It's something that goes on. I mean, if you're all alone somewhere, every 28 days, up to a certain point, mind you, every 28 days from between the time you're 12, 50, 55 or so, somewhere approximately there, you have this rather messy, unpleasant reminder, painful often, at least it still is for me, that you are a woman. And it seems as mysterious. I'm 50 years old, as I say, and I'm apparently near the end of it, but it seems as mysterious and strange as when it first appeared when I was about 13 years old. It's called your menstrual period. Nothing is as clear that you're a woman as this event. It's something that I think it often is politically, certainly American feminists, I think, of a certain kind, do not like to really speak about this. But a woman's reproductive life is really the center of all things. And we can take care of it in all sorts of ways, you know, make it easy, certainly make it hidden from view. Though I've often wondered how astronauts hide it or how women in the army hide it, how they go about these bodily things.
Now, you said to me that in matters of survival, you did not feel yourself to be surviving as a black person or as a woman, but surviving as your mother's daughter.
yes, simply because my mother, I was always aware of that she had a power over her children's life. And, you know, I don't know if her sons paid attention, and well, they were younger than I, but I was the oldest one, and I was aware that she had extraordinary power over our ability to be in the world since, well, I noticed that I was that she was 30 when I was born, and that that was very late for a woman in our culture, unless she was very chaste, and my mother never gave me the impression that she was chaste. She always seemed incredibly attractive sexually. So it became clear to me that my being born was her will, or a failure of her will, but it was deliberate on her part. And then I witnessed, you know, various stopping of her children being born, and that the ones that were born, two were born because she wanted that, and the third boy was born against her will. He was tried very hard to be not born, and he was born anyway. I'm very aware of this feeling of being alive because my mother willed it. I think it's always when people begin arranging and controlling the life of a woman is what they mean to do. They cannot bear that this person might have such power. And I think all the rules of controlling reproduction is really a way of taking away from women this power.
It seems that your books in particular, Annie, John, and Lucy, by being written in a style that is deceptively simple. Now, I know after years how much that style, in fact, is the solution to the presentation of great and complicated difficulties. But certain books started to be taught in America largely because their language and their sentence structure were available enough to be taught in schools. As a result, and it's with great pleasure for me, as I read your books in public places, as I often do, or reread them, I get stopped. And when I say that I'm going to be talking to Jamaica Kincaid this afternoon, she's going to be on my show Bookworm, I'm Michael Silverblatt, they say, would you thank her for writing that book?
That's very kind.
There's a very interesting kind of gratitude, and by accident, finally, for the first time, it does seem to me that these books are reaching an audience that needs them. This is not like seventh or eighth graders being given The Sun Also Rises because Ernest Hemingway writes a simple sentence. These are books that are of vital concern to the people reading them at that age. They are being exposed, in fact, to beautiful literature and style, but also to a subject to which they respond.
Yes. Well, the style that seems simple hides, you know, we've talked about incredible hostility and underground currents.
After those first two books, I noticed that the sentences begin to grow.
Yes.
And to exfoliate. Their narrators are no longer children, and so the sentences are no longer simple sentences.
Yes. Yes. Well, I wanted to say more complicated things. I still do, you know. I wanted to express the complications of the world, how every person victorious looks forward to defeat, how every defeated person looks forward to victory, and how so many times people just, you know, over hundreds of years, people just change places, and how to hear out of the mouth of the victor, you know, a lament of woundedness, how complicated it all is. I'd like to say those things, but I sometimes feel a mere book that no medium I know can contain them. And so I have to discipline myself to this medium I am in, which is a book, and how to say that. And actually, if you were to see the things I'm writing now, I'm sure no one will read them but you, Michael, because they are so complicated. I now realize that I simply write in parentheses, that I say something and then it leads to huge, one book later I can pick up the sentence that I just stated, that as I write and as I look more and more, the world I know becomes more and more almost like a strange embroidered sheet, and I can't tell how it begins, but it's very beautiful.
Fascinating, because I now that I think of it, William Gass, who's recently become interested in your writing, and I believe he's done several interviews with you for the Lannan Foundation, one of his first published stories, The Peterson Kid, is in simple sentences, willfully so.
Yes.
Hemingway sentences.
Yes.
By now, his sentences are miasmic, little microcosms of complexity.
They are amazing.
Astonishing sentences.
Yeah.
And I wondered whether, in fact, it is not simplicity a decision of manner and complexity the nature of who we are, the
Absolutely.
Soul.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think that for a writer to continue in that, if you begin in a simple text and you continue in it, you're soon trapped in it because your natural impulse, you're all the time thinking in these complicated mazes, and you deliberately set out to take one step, two step, three step, all deliberately clear. And then after a while, the natural consciousness of the complications, you know, of things just overwhelm. The world has been going on, and especially after 1492, in a strange pell-mell, back-and-forth way. And we all want to render it, all of us writers want to render it with some moral continuity, with some beginning and end, and some denouement that makes sense and is just, and it will not work that way.
In that same sense that writers are correcting or writing a given order imposed upon them, there's also the order of a story, whether that be beginning, middle, and end, or plot, a set of causal consequences that lead, as you say, to a denouement. And most writers who are serious find themselves wrestling with the obligations that stories impose upon them. And then it's been said that women writers are wrestling with an additional obligation that causal order is identified with patriarchal thinking. I'm not sure why. Do you have any feelings about it?
Well, I've never considered patriarchy as something to be respected, and that might be because I grew up in such a powerful matriarchy. No one I knew when I was growing up respected the power of men. And their whole lives were spent undermining it. In fact, the very idea that I could have a marriage with a man and equality in it is amazing to me because I didn't grow up with this idea. And so having patriarchal obligations in writing, I don't understand. I love a plot, and I love a beginning, and I love a middle, and I love an end. But I myself am not capable of writing such a thing. And I think really any good writer today, anyone really thinking about writing and language, would have no use for such obligations, men or women, though I seem to think that certainly the good women writers have no obligations to this. So the thing comes to an end, quite not unlike the way, the goddesses come and cut the string, and it's ended. You know, the question of women writing is has more to do with having a sense of yourself. I mean, writing being such a powerful thing. I mean, I was thinking that one of the ways you're often robbed of owning yourself is to be told, is to be forbidden to read and to write, because when you begin to read or write, or when you begin to think about yourself and then to be able to express it, which is what reading and writing is, it's a very elemental part of freedom. When you begin to do that, you're beginning to disrupt the whole thing. You're beginning to undermine it. And it is really very much why people, I think, never want slaves, for instance, to read or write, or to control what people read and write. And for a woman to write is, and to write about herself, especially a woman in a colonial situation or a slave situation, is very threatening, because they begin to undermine the whole thing. I feel very sad for men that they came up with this pathetic idea called patriarchy, because now they just have to spend the rest of eternity atoning for it, letting go of it, defending it. Oh, it's a very sad thing, patriarchy.
When you speak of a woman in a colonial situation or a slave situation as a writer, what are they bringing that is distinctly a woman's sensibility to the writing?
Well, they, for a time anyway, until they themselves are out of the situation, they will tell to the world that, you see that dress you're wearing, hair is how it got made. You see that food, that delicious food, you see your children, this is how it's all worked. One of the, you know, very confusing things is how quick it is to go from slave to master, and how confusing it is, because the thing that the slaves in their situation will leave out is the joy of mastering, and the thing that the master forgets is the despair of the slave. So the slave often brings to the master the real life of what a person is, the real life, the real understanding of what the master is enjoying. You know, there's this wonderful thing in a novel, Mansfield Park by Jane Austen, and it's not one of her novels that people like, because it's a very dark novel. And you know, Lord Bertram goes off to his estate, and he's very cruel to Fanny before he goes, certainly dismissive of her. And he comes back, and Austen makes him very vulnerable to her, very kind to her, and tries to arrange a nice life for her. And what you can see that Austen imbued his character with was what he saw. And what he saw was this great cruelty to defenseless people, and he comes back and saves up all his pity for this one defenseless person in his household. It's very good for masters to keep women and people, and you know, and all these situations of servitude begin to devolve from the situation of women. You know, it's not really an accident that Southern men are so courteous to women, because they're so cruel to their slaves and loved having slaves, and a woman was really a slave treated kindly, if you like that kind of kindness.
Well, to talk about that deeply, in Mansfield Park there is the situation that Fanny is regarded as being morally trivial, yes? And it is the critical response that it is her dawning complexity to which the men are responding. She's required to grow, and she feels, yes, but whose idea of growth? And into what form?
Yes.
And what am I to grow as?
Yes.
What am I to be?
Yes.
And I think it makes for the very dark and perplexing quality of that narrative.
Oh, yes. And also hovering over this is this word that's mentioned maybe three times, you know, abolition in the novel, and Lord Bertrand's departure to this place called Antigua, which might as well be a black hole. It's so, well, as a matter of fact, it was a black hole, a moral black hole. I think, in a way, her work would be really kind of incomplete and not very interesting if it didn't have a novel like Mansfield Park in it.
To complicate.
It's a very complicated novel, and in some ways, you know, weird when she goes back to her her family and leaves again. And it's not entirely complete the way the others are, just fit. And you don't read it in that
spell of satisfaction.
Yes. But it's, for me, her best book, and I've read it many times.
Mansfield Park, me too. I have a final question. Your book, your newest book, My Garden, would conventionally be taken to be a woman's book.
How I wish.
Gardening. But most of the nursery people that you encounter in the book are men, and many of the transactions in the book are with men. And I noticed, too, that you took particular satisfaction in an interview with Martha Stewart about this book, for whom the woman's role, mastering the woman's role, is a matter of management, of becoming managerial.
Yes.
And I wanted to discuss that facet of your writing and of that interview, because it's fascinating to me.
Oh, well, I have to tell you, first of all, that the world of gardening, of horticulture, and specifically in America today, is dominated by gay men and probably gay white men. I've never really met a black horticultural gardener. But not only that, the world of American horticulture today is more segregated than golf. Most people in gardening are white. I loved talking to Martha Stewart, and I defend her, not because I know her at all. I just like her. I like domestic life on the whole. I like housekeeping. And I think everybody ought to do it, men and women. There's something lovely about a clean shirt and you're making it clean. It's really actually the most useful thing to do is to make a home, and it's really much better, more satisfying than an IPO or becoming a billionaire, as Martha Stewart apparently just did. It's not interesting that she's a billionaire. It's very interesting that she will make something out of absolutely nothing. Well, apparently, I've never done any of those things, but the idea, you know, of making a pumpkin into something interesting. Women have always done that, and it's always been fine, but suddenly this woman comes along and makes $1 billion out of this trivial, supposedly trivial thing. I think that's what really antagonizes people, that this thing that's been dismissed, make a bed, my God, let's pay another woman less to make a bed. Everything that has been dismissed and trivialized and really rudely stepped upon in our society, including by some of us women, she comes along and makes $1 billion out of it, and she's much hated. I think if a man had done it, and men do, men make billions of dollars out of gardening and bench building. You know, they have little hobbies, and on Saturday afternoons they make little tables and all sorts of little things, and it's all fine. But a woman comes along and tells you how to turn down your bed before you go into it and rumple it all up again is somehow a fool. But every time a woman does something, it's really given more scrutiny and much easier to dismiss. So I don't know. I like the idea that there is someone who just will examine every niche of domesticity and really wants to present it as something comforting. I myself rather like that. I try to go around my house, and I'm always doing something. I mean, you know, have you ever been to Monet's house?
Yes.
Well, Monet's house is right out of Martha Stewart. It's got these oddly painted chairs. Everything is very, you know, colorful, and it's all his. And no one ever says, why is he doing that? Oh, no, he's quite revered, and his garden is treasured, and
Well, it brings me to what brings us to mind is that the best instance I know of Martha Stewart was when someone told me that the bird bath that they had in their garden had moss growing all over it.
Ooh.
Because of Martha Stewart.
Ooh.
Who had told the secret that if you paint the sides of the bird bath with yogurt, moss will grow more quickly. Now, this begins to bring back another quintessential role.
What a wonderful
the person
idea.
In charge of mysteries. The person who knows is connected to secrets of nature. And it brings us full circle back to that idea we opened with, that a woman knows she's a woman because she menstruates.
Yes.
Because of the monthlies. And that woman's knowledge, quote unquote, is knowing what to do
yes.
about the secrets of nature
yes.
ruled by the moon.
Yes. Oh, that's so yogurt, huh? I'm going to go home and do it immediately. Well, you know, the truth is we are so willing to dismiss what women know. I remember telling a friend when I first came to America, a feminist, that my mother and her friends were always tinkering with their womb, either to make it strong so it would bear a child or make it weak so it wouldn't bear a child. They were practicing a form of birth control with herbs. And she said to me, oh, that's impossible. You can't have an abortion through ingesting things. And I thought, well, I know my mother had controlled her life in this way. And they did it. And of course, it's true. The idea, you know, that women now must depend on our U48 or something, you know, they're things they've always known how to do. And it has been made illegitimate because it's not scientific. It's only legitimate if you can figure out how it squares two and two. But if it's just intuitive, and I mean, I think it's really done to all people from the fringes of the world, from the non-scientific people who haven't had or are not interested in the Enlightenment, that any knowledge they have is dismissible unless you can, you know, make it artificially, unless you can figure out how it works.
Reproduce it.
Yes, in a lab. But it's really been a terrible thing that women turned over their lives, that part of their lives, to science. It was a sort of very bad day. Perhaps it was even a bad day when women became Christians.
I've been speaking to Jamaica Kincaid. It's the occasion of her publication of my garden book, published by Farrah, Straus & Giroux, but it is part of Bookworm's ongoing series, Women, Writing, and the Imagination.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Bookworm. I'm Michael Silverblatt. My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer is Jennifer Swadek. Special production assistance by Alan Howard. Join us again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in the bus.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is made available to the public radio system by SAS, a satellite service of KCRW Santa Monica. Cassette copies of this and other Bookworm programs are available. For ordering information, call KCRW at 310-450-5183.
Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasure, friends in prose and rhyme.
Now with Book of the Mouse.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.